Hello, Dubcast. I'm Johnny King's George. The spring game has finally sprung. It happened. Spring. It started. Yes, it sprang. It sprung. It sprout. It's here. Let's talk about it. Hi. By the way, how are you? How are you, George? I'm sorry. I feel like we just got into it. I wasn't very cordial of me. How are things?
We don't. What do you mean? We never start out in cordial fashion. We just
I know, but I want
week.
You know.
But I'm new year, just new me. Dandy. I'm rearing to get discussion going on what we saw in the spring game and why I'm not really too concerned about the ups and the downs relative to everything that happened, particularly around the quarterbacks. And as someone that has been singing the praises of Julian Sayin for the last couple of weeks, so.
You're not ready to start him at this point.
I'm ready to embrace the adversity that comes with, riding that train. So right. let's get into it. But I hope you're doing well too, Johnny.
I'm doing great. Here's the thing. I went to the spring game. I will say I did not attend the entirety of the spring game. I decided.
How could
so I
you?
Went. Well, so I went
it was
with
a
my wife.
Ball game. Based on the
well,
scoring that nobody really understands.
That's right. And nobody knows how the offense ended up winning. I went to the
results
game
are made with, up and the points don't matter.
That's right. That, well, yeah,
the whose line is it anyway of college
Ohio
football?
Native. I went to the game with my wife and my toddler son, and I think he was very patient for a 2.5-year-old. We got through the first quarter.
That's about all you could ask.
Yeah. I mean, he was playing like cards and stuff like that while we were doing it, but he did a great job. But there was a point at which we had to tap out and do nap time and go home. And that was, about halfway through the second quarter. And that was enough for me to see all of the, the quarterbacks kind of take a turn, trying to conduct a drive. And it was enough to see, how the secondary was holding up, things like that. And then, when I got home and I saw highlights later and I rewatched it and all that stuff, I got to see the rest of the game. But it was a great time. 80,000 people, I think, was announced, like 80,012 or something like that. Beautiful day. It feels like sometimes on the spring game, it's either blazingly hot, like the sun is just beating down on you and you want to die. Or it's like 40 and raining. So this was a pleasant change, a pleasant surprise from a lot of the years past spring games that I've been to. So it was a great environment, a lot of fun. Band was there, a lot of cool things going on. Nationally broadcast game, which is a big deal. That also kind of changed, I think, the dynamic of a lot of things and how it worked in terms of timing and whatnot.
Yeah, I was expecting it to be on Big Ten Network, and then I was like, oh, wait, this is the
Fox?
Purdue game is on here. So are we
That's
on
right.
the prime time? And in fact, there we were on Fox.
Yeah, so it was a big deal. It was fun. And look, the first thing we're going to talk about is the quarterback play, because I think that's what, a lot of the 80,000 people who showed up wanted to see, what they were interested about, what they wanted to, learn and maybe get some kind of inkling about who the starter might be.
Who can we
I don't know.
Make indictments on? And
Yeah, that's right. Yes, exactly. Like, set the agenda for however we want to feel for the next like 6 months. And what should we feel angry about and or happy? Here's the deal.
There's no happiness. There's only anger when you're an Ohio State fan.
That's right. Exactly.
Disappointment.
That's what Buckeye fans
Unless
are
you win
by.
A national title.
That's right. And even then for like 5 minutes. Chris wrote about this in the aftermath of the spring game, that there wasn't a whole lot of clarity that that simulated scrimmage kind of provided. I think all of the quarterbacks showed some good things and some not good things. Some showed more not good things than others. Julian Sayin, we'd been talking about him, and there'd been a lot of hype about him at spring practices, and he looked like a freshman. I mean, he made mistakes, he made some good throws, but he also looked like a guy who wasn't about to supplant some of the more experienced guys anytime soon. Now, again, I think he has a lot of talent. The arm talent, the delivery, all that stuff, if you watch him, on the field, he looks great. But I also think that it's pretty obvious that this is a guy who hasn't played any college football, and that's okay. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. But I also think that if there's a lack of clarity about who the starter is going to be, that favors Will Howard. Because what college coaches are going to do in almost every instance when it comes to the quarterback play is they want to go with the sure thing. And if all other things being equal, they're going to go with the guy who is a multi-year starter at another D1 program, you know, who is like in his fifth year, things like that. So unless somebody really, really steps up and takes this thing, I would be very surprised if Will Howard wasn't the dude.
Well, I'm going to go back to the parallel that I drew relative to how they approached prepping for the Cotton Bowl, which is that they went with the guy that was presumably more experienced, if not necessarily the better arm talent.
Sure.
And when Devin Brown got hurt, it became very apparent that even though Kainholz maybe could have potentially put the team in a position to win, they didn't give him enough preparation and reps in practice to where that would have made a tangible difference on the field. And I kind of feel the same way about, even though Julian Sain hasn't really had a lot of on-field college football experience yet, if you were to put the reps and the resources behind that guy towards making him the starter, I still think the long-term ceiling, for the sake of what the team is going to get, is better than what you're going to get out of Will Howard. I thought, barring that one interception that Sain threw, which of course everybody's going to point to coming out as like, oh, that is disqualifying of him in the quarterback process now. He's now been thrusted down to at least third, potentially even lower down the list. He had a pretty comparable performance to what Will Howard did, I think, not only in terms of the distance of throws that they were making, but also what they did with their just overall reps and showing command of the offense. So I don't really think that there was a lot of ground that was made up or lost necessarily between those two. And I'm still pretty thoroughly convinced, based on arm talent, that Sain is going to give this team a higher ceiling than Howard, or at least the offense a higher ceiling than Howard would, just based on the ability to make throws at all levels of the field and getting the most out of the receiving core. But I can understand why some people would be more concerned with Sain coming out of that than you know, someone like me who's been kind of talking him up for the last couple of weeks. I still think it comes down to you like putting your like frontline running with the ones practice reps, allocating those towards one guy that you want to make your starter, is going to end up making more of a difference here than kind of doing the platooning thing that they did for not only the first few weeks of last season heading into the Notre Dame game, but also in the, you know, when August practice started going into the beginning parts of September. So that's more of what I wanted to see. What I think is the more interesting development relative to this entire quarterback room from the spring game is that Aaron Nolan certainly seemed more, had a much better day, at least, than we saw from Lincoln Kainholz. And you kind of wonder where, you know, where this was maybe a 3-4 person conversation heading into the weekend. Has it become firmly a 4-player conversation now, but has Kainholz kind of fallen behind Aaron Nolan in the pecking order in terms of figuring out what the future quarterback room is going to look like?
Yeah, that's the question that I kind of have. Like, I don't know what, I mean, we've got, and especially as of the publication of this episode, right, you'll have the portal being opened. And I am very curious to see what happens with the quarterback room, because it's not going to look the same. That's for sure, right? There is no chance that you retain all five guys coming through the spring transfer portal. So I mean, if you're Ryan Day, I think that you've got to be really upfront with the guys that you have in terms of, like, you have an absolute shot of winning this job versus you need to find someplace else in your own best interest, right? Not necessarily because of Ohio State. Ohio State's got, you know, an embarrassment of riches at the quarterback position. It's in your best interest to find a place right now where you can, like, maybe compete for a starting job in the fall.
And I would and expect, I think they have several
guys that can do that
based on how he handled Kyle McCord after the Michigan game.
Yeah.
So I have no reason to believe that Day's not going to be upfront about that.
No, I think he will too. And I'm just curious to see. I mean, that's going to give us a lot of clarity on what the pecking order kind of looks like, because, you know, we haven't talked about Devin Brown and all this, and Devin Brown, I think, had a day that was roughly comparable to most of the other guys. I think he did well. He had some really good throws. He showed some mobility that I think was oversold, you know, last year. I mean, that was kind of supposed to be his thing. And he looked good. He looked good against a really good defense in terms of like finding ways to pick up yards.
A really good defense that couldn't hit him.
Right. And that's the other thing that I kind of want to talk about, though, because I really, especially, I mean, position a quarterback. Oh, you see the throws, you see how guys, you know, handle the pocket and things like that. That was one of the things with Julian saying that I was, you know, a little like, okay, like he got a sack, for example, that was based on him just not feeling the pressure coming from his left side, which is a big problem. Like that's something.
There was one point he was getting back to back.
Right. And so that's something you got to work on and improve. But again, it's hard to kind of to get really concrete answers on some of these things, particularly at positions like the running back position, for example. Like there was a lot of cool stuff that I saw. I thought Henderson was super mobile and looked really good. And Quinshon Judkins looked really great. But you have no idea because they're not like, you know, if they're down as soon as they get touched or guys aren't really blocking in the same way that they normally would, it's, you really can't get a beat on that at all. So I appreciated what I saw. I like some, you know, watching some of the younger running backs, the guys who were just coming on, Williams, Dixon and Peoples, but I don't, you know, that doesn't mean a whole lot. I was hoping Jeremiah Smith would come out and do like some crazy, like Randy Moss stuff. We didn't get to see a whole lot of that, unfortunately, but you know, physically the routes that he's running, I mean, it's pretty obvious that he's a true talent and truly elite. So I'm excited about that. But you know, all in all, like that's the thing there, the spring game provides you with limited knowledge and it's hard to extrapolate, based on what you see in a highly, you know, like a highly, simulated, right. What's the word I'm looking for? It's something that's very well coordinated. That isn't like a live game situation. Yeah. And it's hard to really get a lot of information from that. Yeah. Yeah. Something very rehearsed. That's a good way to put it. So I don't know. I mean, like I said, a really great time at Ohio Stadium. I love the spring game just in principle, because I like the idea that families and people who wouldn't normally be able to go to Ohio Stadium and see their favorite team can do it for a low price and, you know, and check it out and have a good time. I love that aspect of it. But in terms of like, you know, determining how much the football team needs to improve upon or how great they are, I don't know how much you're going to get. I will say though, the defense, it looks really professional in terms of the way they go about their business, stuck to their routes, assignments, all that kind of stuff, especially in the secondary, looks great. Defensive line should be very, very good. Especially, you know, they're from some guys that we may not, you know too much about. They looked mobile and active. So I was excited about that aspect of it, but again, it's, you know, it's kind of hard to really, you know, make concrete proclamations about this stuff at this
point. What did you think about the T formation from Chip Kelly?
I thought that was funny
about that.
I enjoy that. I liked how they did the little spin move as like, you know, like an homage to, I guess, Woody. I don't know. You know, who knows what he's actually got cooking. I don't think that in the 15 practices that they had in the spring, they're really going to completely revamp the offense. It looked pretty much the same as it did last year, but I am excited to see what Chip Kelly tries to do. That the idea of having both Judkins and Henderson on the field at the same time is like, that is my dream. If that actually happens as a central component of the offense, I will cry tears of joy just because I think that's hilarious and awesome. But I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I would like to see a lot of those twin flex formations too.
Be incredible.
Not necessarily T formation. You know,
power eye.
It's funny that
Judkins as a fullback.
I mean, it's funny that, you know, we brand Chip Kelly as this like revolutionary offensive guru, and mm-hmm. the first thing he does at Ohio State is you know, throw the playbook back to the 50s and the 60s. So it's I guess in terms of subverting expectations, Chip Kelly's off to a good start in that department. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, so, if Judkins is apparently one of, like, you know, getting these rave reviews as like one of the best players in the offense already, then yeah, they would be, I think, doing a disservice to themselves to not find a way to incorporate both of those guys on the field at the same time,
100%.
Particularly if they are, you know, potentially catering towards making more of a run first, or not even run first, but just a dual threat option like Devin Brown or Will Howard, one of the starters, then you would think that putting as many potential ball carriers on the field together to kind of like keep the defense honest would be the best, you know, course of action for them. My bigger thing that I'm going to be more concerned about is, you know, it's great, you know, to have a dynamic rushing attack, but the thing that really let me down last year was they did not use the running backs in check down situations as much as I think that they needed to for how
great point. Yeah.
Pocket heavy,
especially when you've got Henderson, who was a great pass catcher.
Right.
Was,
and I'm not really sure what Judkins' receiving capabilities are, but if you at least have a guy like Henderson, who's able to catch passes like that consistently out of the backfield, I would hope that we see that more as a safety valve of sorts this year. For
100%.
You know, the likes of whoever they end up making the starter, whether it's someone as inexperienced as Sayan, who is apparently going to need help navigating the pocket based on what we saw in the spring game, or someone like Howard, who may have trouble hitting deeper areas of the field and would need a more reliable check, like an assortment of reliable check down options. So I just hope that they're drilling that more than we, you know, saw it last year and didn't really necessarily get to see in the spring game. But again, you shouldn't really be drilling check downs in the spring game anyway. You should be trying to get your downfield offense more rehearsed than stuff that can easily be arranged in practice and you know, you don't necessarily want to have on film anyway. So
I kind of
we'll see what they're doing behind the scenes.
Yeah. And I kind of wonder, you know, in terms of the passing game, a lot of people are talking about Jeremiah Smith being, you know, unbelievably good. And he's absolutely, you know, every bit of the hype that people are giving to him. So maybe we've been looking at this backwards. If it's like people talking about who's the quarterback, maybe the question is who has the best rapport with the wide receivers, right? Maybe it's not necessarily who's like the most experienced or who, like, you know, brings an extra dimension or whatever, but who can distribute it to Jeremiah Smith, right? Who can get it to his playmakers? If that's just like, I mean, you know, if Devin Brown all of a sudden just clicks with Jeremiah Smith, maybe that's just what you have to do. Maybe you have to, like, whoever it is, not necessarily, you know, Devin Brown, but I'm just saying whoever it is, if that's your most elite offensive player, okay, then maybe that's the guy that you have to have distributing to him. Maybe it's okay if it's like, you know, somebody who's just going to be that kind of game manager, be that JT Barrett. I don't necessarily think that anybody on the roster right now is capable of being somebody at the level of CJ Stroud, right, in 2024. I don't think that's going to happen.
No, but I think I'm not eventually convinced that Smith is further up the pecking order than Ikpuka yet either. And that's why it would be more important, regardless of whoever clicks with Smith, I want a person that is going to more effectively distribute the ball to as many eligible parties as necessary. And that's why
I think Sayan's
a better candidate,
like,
for that than Howard or Brown, just based on arm talent at this point.
Yeah. Well, we got to see. I mean, there's a lot that can be done over the summer. That's a lot that's going to happen in fall camp. I'm really excited to see, like I said, how that pecking order shakes out, especially, you know, when the transfer portal.
But the way that you build chemistry like that is with consistent allocation of practice reps. And you're splitting those among an assortment of quarterbacks, you're doing a disservice to your offense, which
happened
early last year.
Yeah,
I don't want to rehash the same mistakes that they made early in the season.
I think they need to figure out who that guy is going to be early in camp and just ride or die. Like, I don't really have much of a dog in this fight, but I absolutely agree with that. You cannot, especially with young wide receivers, especially with a lot of new guys, you got to get those guys reps. I 100% agree with that. So interesting spring game, a lot that's going to happen here between now and early August when all of this gets rolling. A couple things happened over the weekend with recruiting in regards to Ohio State football. So Ohio State got a 4-star tight end, Nate Roberts, commitment. He's from Washington, Oklahoma, which is very confusing. Maybe he's from Oklahoma, Washington. Maybe I got that backwards. I don't know. But definitely an area
he is from where the wind goes sweeping down the plane. You're correct.
and is Surrey. Tight end's an interesting position at Ohio State because we had a guy, Cade Stover, who obviously is very accomplished in some aspects of his game and not as accomplished in other aspects, to the consternation of Ohio State fans. So I think that that's an interesting area of contention. And, 4-star, I think he was Ohio State's top target, 6'4", 235, big guy. Going to be interesting to see how he is involved in the offense. And this is a recruiting class that's pretty highly ranked. I think they're close to the top, if not at the top at this point. So they got Nate Roberts as a commitment. And then another commitment, Cody Haddad committed, a 3-star safety out of Cleveland. So interesting, people are like, oh, 30 ranked athlete, but it's Cleveland St. Ignatius. So that's kind of a big deal. I don't know. Interesting pick. So we'll see how those go. And, you always want some good news coming out of the spring game. There were a ton of visitors, dozens of people were on campus. I actually saw somebody at the library who was doing one of the tours. I don't know who it was. Sorry, I can't give you.
Did you give him a library card?
Yeah. It's like, hey, Columbus Library. So many things it offers. Also recruiting, this is some basketball stuff. Ohio State landed 5-star point guard Marcus Johnson. Jake Diebler, landing a commitment out of the point guard from Garfield Heights in Cleveland. Number 4 ranked point guard in the class. I think the number 1 recruit in the state of Ohio for 2026. That's cool. That's good news. Also, it's 2026. So until he's actually on campus and playing basketball, it's hard to get super excited about it. But it does show, I think, that Diebler's out here making some moves, trying to get some things done, bringing in some staff that a lot of people are highly respected, that people are high on. So I'm all about that.
It's interesting timing relative to Michi Johnson coming back.
Yes, it is. It is. And I think a lot of people would say that that is, not at all a coincidence. Marcus Johnson is a cousin of Michi Johnson, who, of course, announced his return to Ohio State. And I wouldn't say that is, that's a coincidence. I think that probably one very possibly had to do with the other. So that's cool. I like that Diebler's out here making moves and, doing everything he can to improve the team. And obviously this is, it's something that's a little bit down the pike, but you want to keep that momentum that you had at the end of the season going, right? So I'm excited about
we
it.
Talked about what we didn't, the big question mark for Diebler was going to be, okay, what is your roster building going to, there were a lot of reasons for optimism from, the time he assumed the interim role to the end of the year in terms of X's and O's, but what is your roster building behavior going to look like that we're
exactly.
kind of in this?
And it's one thing to be a coach, but you got to manage an entire program, and this is a sign that he's doing a good job.
It's a good step, but it's an in-state hit, so this is like one of those things that you would hope you'd be able to hit on this. And kind of similar thing with Michi, just in terms of like someone that was here before that's now coming back. So I want to feel good about this, but until we get something that's purely organic, maybe one of these Kentucky castoffs now that Calipari's jumped ship, which we're going to talk about a little bit later, I'm not going to feel totally convinced about short-term comfort relative to roster building ability. These feel like kind of, low-hanging fruit, close to home,
close to home, cousin of a guy coming back,
satisfying that need for this team. So he's done a good job for it so far. I still want to see a bigger splash relative to going out and getting someone that doesn't necessarily have pre-existing program ties. How is he going to convince somebody that, you know, is talented to come fill a role for this team that they still have several needs to fill right now?
Mm-hmm.
What is his ability going to be like relative to, you know, other people that may be recruiting through the transfer portal right now? Well, I think it still kind of needs to be seen.
Yeah, and the transfer portal is what it's all about, man. I mean, that was one of the knocks against Chris Holtmann, is that you would get these guys in the transfer portal, you would prioritize certain guys, and not only did they not work out, but they ended up taking up a roster spot that costs you when you're trying to recruit other guys later on, and that was just, did not work out. I mean, now, there were a few transfers. I don't want to say they were all misses. There were a few really, really great transfers that Holtmann was able to kind of nail, but like for the most part, it felt like there were a lot of high profile misses and missed opportunities where he could have easily improved his team in areas of need. So Diebler's got to be better than Holtmann was on that, and that he will have the opportunity to be better very, very soon. So that's a big deal. And you know, that's the thing about, you know, that's the thing about basketball. We tend to just kind of forget about it. You know, it comes in our lives for a little bit, and then we're like, okay, well, then here comes spring practices and the spring game. And then it's the off season, and, you know, everybody's just kind of like going for content or whatever. But if you're an Ohio State basketball fan, a men's basketball fan, start paying attention now, because this is where the Diebler regime, that's when it really starts, is him rebuilding the team, trying to get transfer guys in the portal. Right now is when that starts. That whole process begins in April and through May, and the recruiting that happens over the summer. So keep an eye on that. Pay attention to that, because that's a big deal going forward. All right, so we want to do Ask Us Anything. Of course, it's our favorite part of the show. But before we do, I want to remind you that the Dubcast is sponsored by the Dry Goods Store at 11warriors.com. Shirts, hats, stickers, check it out. It's great. By the way, it's in the mail. It's on the way. I did get an Ohio State women's national championship hockey shirt.
Very
so
nice.
I will be rocking that on the Dubcast very soon. I'm excited for it. It was not cheap, but I said I'd do it, and I'm gonna wear it. I'm getting it. It's a nice shirt too. I got it from home field. So let's go ahead and do Ask Us Anything. You can ask us literally anything by sending us questions to dubcast@11warriors.com. This is from our good friend Alvin, who wants to know, quite simply, what was our favorite childhood cartoon?
Oh, there's so many.
But was there one that you like obsessed over? Because I mean, I was definitely like, you know, on the end of the whole Saturday morning cartoon era, and there were definitely, you know, I would turn on the TV, I'd watch the Fox, you know, Kids or whatever Saturday mornings.
So many to choose. I mean, I would probably have to say Pokemon, which is okay. In that Fox Saturday morning lineup that you're alluding to. But mm-hmm. I mean, God, there's so. I mean, Dexter's Laboratory was so great.
Brilliant show, loved it.
There's a lot of. And I mean, you know, SpongeBob SquarePants, the legacy is just like, it's incredible. So it's hard for me to choose, but I would say those are probably my top three in no particular.
What's interesting is that this is where we can draw the generational line between you and me, because I'm like, I'm about 10 years older than you, right? And it's not a lot in the grand scheme of things, but I do think that there is this shift between kids who grew up watching cable cartoon shows like on the Saturday mornings or when they were off school, and then people like me who still watched all the network stuff. And I kind of like straddle that line as an older millennial, I guess. And I like the really old
this is a long-winded way of Johnny saying his favorite was Sailor Moon.
That's I'm getting to that kidding. No Sailor Moon. Well, I guess we did get Cartoon Network. I never really watched it, but I did know it was on. Dragon Ball Z was cool. I remember watching that.
I wasn't allowed to watch that.
Oh, it's too violent. I
grew up in one of those households.
I got you.
But you know, domesticating creatures like Pokemon against their
will. That's right. Yeah, doing cartoon cockfights with creatures that you capture.
Yeah, you're not allowed to kill people. You know, nothing with,
that's right.
with dead
that's right.
humans, but you know.
Yeah,
animal violence is totally legit.
That's right. I, you know what? I, the shows I really liked, I love Spider-Man. I love the old Spider-Man cartoon from the 90s. I was a big fan of that. I watched the X-Men cartoons. I really like the Batman cartoon, the animated Batman cartoon.
Oh, you're a big Gargoyles fan, too.
I did. Yeah, I watched the crap out of Gargoyles. We talked
about that.
I know. I watched the crap out of Gargoyles. I did not like all the Disney stuff, but Gargoyles was a Disney thing, and it was like the only one that I got into. Yeah, those were crushing those were the big hard ones for
on
me.
Those Gargoyles.
I know. Dang, Desdemona. We're in the loincloth. Jeez. I will also say The Simpsons was a huge part of my childhood growing up. The Simpsons premiered in like 1989, so I was like 4 years old. So it was a constant presence when I was a kid. And you know, like the glory years when I was a kid. So I watched the crap out of that with my, you know, family, right? It was the way it went, it was whatever crappy show was on before The Simpsons, and then it was The Simpsons, and then it was The X-Files, and that was my Sunday night for pretty much my entire childhood, and it was awesome. I absolutely loved it. So as great as those Saturday morning cartoons were, I think The Simpsons still pretty much reigned supreme over everything else because it ruled. So
did you watch Pokemon though?
The Pokemon first season came on, when did that come out? Like in 97, 98? Like that.
Around that was when the games came out, so it was probably around the same time.
I didn't really watch. I think it was a little bit, you know, I was like 12, 13, so I was kind of getting to that point where I was like, no, I'm not gonna watch Pokemon, I'm gonna watch, you know.
Okay, I had whatever. A funny story from the first season, but if you don't remember the arcs, I'm not gonna.
I don't, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I know Pikachu like shocked the Ash, I think, the a bunch of times, but that's
that's like one of the things. But no, there's a very for any listeners out there familiar with the Bye Bye Butterfree episode, I cried like a baby when he let Butterfree go, and I remember asking my mother through tears why he did it. Why would he let his first fully evolved Pokemon go? It made no sense. It was more of a frustrated cry than a sad cry. It's like, Ash, you invested all this time, you idiot.
Don't.
What are you doing?
You fool. No, but that sounds hilarious. That's pretty good. I'll have to check out Bye Bye Butterfree then, I guess.
No, it's that's not necessary, but... you'll be an emotional wreck like I was. You don't need that stress at this age.
All right, this next one's from Kevin. He wants to know, how is the Ohio State women's basketball team shaping up next season? That's going to be interesting because first of all, they've got some departures, right? And that's going to be tough, especially with the senior leadership that they're losing. I'm gonna do this in a macro sense, though. I don't want to break down the roster necessarily, in part because I'd look like an idiot, but also because it feels like even when they have the most favorable situation, and I feel like they had a good draw this year in the NCAA tournament, they had a lot of momentum going into it all, although, you know, obviously they kind of blew it in the Big Ten tournament. They underwhelm when they get to March Madness, and it really kind of sucks. And last year, you know, obviously, you know, the year before last, I guess, if you're counting this past year, but in 2023, it felt like they finally had kind of figured it out a little bit, that there was something they could build on. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, they win one and then they're out. And it's like, that's, you want more from this program and from Coach McGuff. And it's unfortunate that, you know, I think they'll get some transfers coming in. That's awesome. That's great. But until I see them really making a run in March, it's hard for me to believe that they're going to be able to be anything better than, like, you know, an occasional Sweet 16 team. That's kind of where I'm at.
It's going to be really hard for them to replace J.C. Sheldon.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's...
I'm very concerned about that. I'm excited to see what Jelloni Cambridge will offer this team. But I'm hopeful that someone who is, you know, a number one overall talent in her position that's coming in would be able to kind of step up into a role like that pretty quickly. I just don't know how much of the production and consistency that Sheldon offered at that position, you know, arguably the most important one for any basketball team, men's or women's, is going to be replicated right away. So I think a lot of it is going to come down to not only who fills J.C. Sheldon's shoes, but if Cambridge ends up being the one to fill that role, what does her development, given her potential talent at, you know, this level, how does that translate into success for Ohio State? So it's
right.
I think it's going to be more of a wait and see approach, and I hope expectations are kind of tempered accordingly. But I mean, this is a program that was number two in the country at one point this season, so obviously,
and beat the national runner up pretty convincingly.
Yeah, so I think that they, you know, expectations should be tempered, but at the same time, there's people internally and externally that are going to be demanding a lot. And I, even though I wouldn't set the ceiling as high, I think that the potential is there for at least them to, you know, potentially put themselves in a position to make another run at the way that they kind of did this year. But, you know, we've said that the last 2 years, and then there's been, I mean, they did obviously better 2 years ago than they did in this past tournament, but we'll see what kind of hiccups and turbulence they encounter along the way. But I'm excited to see what Jelani Cambridge brings to this program.
Yeah. In the transfer portal, you know what? I've heard that there's this player who is really good and has a year of eligibility left. You just have to convince her to not enter the NBA draft and to transfer to another Big Ten team. So I'm just saying, if there's somebody with deep pockets out there who has Caitlin Clark's number, it might be a good move.
She's already doing SNL appearances. That ship has sailed.
No, it's fine. You can do that now. Who cares? That's fine. That's fine. It's fine. It's fine. It's all good. It's all good.
You don't go on SNL to hit the portal afterwards? Come on.
Yeah, why not? Why not? Who says no? You got it. What's the worst thing that you can do if you reach out? She says no. You got to make the call. You got to make the call. This last question.
She did give
Tim.
A very glowing review of Cleveland, so maybe she's got a soft spot for Ohio.
That's right. You've already got your foot in the door. You might as well make the. You know, you got to shoot your shot. All right. So last one here. This is from Tim.
Pun intended.
Tim. That's right. Pun intended, because God knows Caitlin Clark likes to shoot her shots. Last one's from Tim. Tim wants to know, fellas, I know that you guys are big video game fans. Have you been watching the Fallout series, and are you fans of the games? And I know for a fact that you are a fan of the games, George. You are like an academic fan of the games.
That's a great word, because I gave an acclaimed presentation on Fallout 4 for my lit class, my sci-fi lit class at Ohio State, as opposed to having to do a paper on Blade Runner or something.
Yeah.
So I was
stupid crap.
The book, not the movie. So I was that 4 was. It came out when I was a senior. So, you know, the waiting and New Vegas and 3 both came out while I was in high school. So the wait for 4 was very much anticipated. And I didn't actually play 3 or New Vegas really in an appreciable sense until I was in college. So I really did.
You got to have them like back to back to back.
Basically. Oh yeah. No, I mean, I played 3. I played New Vegas like first, like a little bit after it came out, but I wasn't really like super into RPGs back then. So I kind of abandoned it before I even hit like level 5 or anything. But then when 4 was getting ready to come out, I think like a year or two before that, I played 3. And then I played New Vegas while I was like doing a summer internship, like a year later. Like I would come home from work and then I'd have that, and it was great. And then I really got to appreciate 4 when I was a senior. And it was, you know, 4 had its quirks. Definitely not the same RPG elements that I think a lot of people enjoy, particularly the dialogue system compared to.
I actually think that was the most disappointing part. As somebody who really loved New Vegas, like to me, the fact that the way they did dialogue, and like you would pick kind of a vibe, you would pick a mood or an emotion, and then the game would tell you, like it wouldn't tell you exactly how you would respond. Whereas, especially in New Vegas, like you have very specific things that you're like telling other characters. Oh, yeah. And that shapes the interaction. No, and you have like little
personality traits and perks that are aligned with your helpful dialogue.
Yeah, exactly. And 4 didn't really have that, which kind of stinks. But 4 is a really fun game to play, to actually play in a moment-to-moment basis. The gunplay is really fun. The, you know,
it's much better and less clunkier than the earlier games were.
Yeah, 100%. And it's brighter. There's, you know, I think the art design's better. I also played it in such a way that it was extremely funny for me. So I did a melee character, which is not really something that you're supposed to do.
I did that the second time.
Yeah, you can do pretty much whatever you want in that game, but I just went around punching the crap out of things, and it was very funny to me. And I just played the biggest idiot in the wasteland, just punching my way out of situations, and I really enjoyed that. But, you know, all this to say, I think we're both fans of the games. And you know, I'll play Fallout 5 sometime in the 2040s, I'm sure. But
well, before you get into the show, I just want to clarify, like I've become totally disenchanted with the franchise because of the disaster that was the launch of 76.
Yeah,
and it's made me lose all enthusiasm in Bethesda products, which is why I figured Starfield was going to be a letdown, and it kind of was.
Yeah,
no expectations for Elder Scrolls 6 after that, and because of all of that, the show, even though people are like, oh, it's, you know, it's good, I'm like, okay, no thanks. I've kind of scratched that itch relative to Fallout. I've had
that's fair.
Of the nuclear apocalypse as I think I have needed, so
yeah,
but no thanks.
As far as the games go, that's the thing. As far as the games go, I was like a little salty that, because I have a PS5, and I was a little salty that Microsoft was, you know, laying claim to Starfield, and I wouldn't be able to play it right away, and I think eventually it'll go to the PlayStation. But then it came out, and everybody's like, eh, this isn't that great. And I was like, okay, well, why? And it looks like a lot of the problems that existed in 4 were kind of exacerbated with Starfield, which is like boring dialogue choices, not great quest lines, stuff like that. And I'm playing, and I like RPGs a lot. I'm playing Baldur's Gate 3 right now, and that's nothing but like banger quest lines, like one after the other. All the characters are really, really interesting and awesome. All the dialogue choices are hilarious and amazing. There's so much crap you can do. And I'm like, oh, I don't know that I'm missing out on a whole lot. So I'm with you, honestly. Like, I'm not excited that much about the Elder Scrolls next one that comes out in 20 years or whatever it actually releases. I'm not like super stoked about, you know, whatever new Fallout thing. And I honestly wasn't that pumped about the series for a lot of the same reasons. I will say this, the interesting thing about Fallout, what I think makes it something that's worthy to talk about and to kind of think about, is that it's a cool, first of all, setting is really interesting and cool, and the way they do it, you know, this proto 50s future thing, you know, and they've all the jingoism and nationalism that kind of, you know, they satirize and all that kind of stuff. That's great. It's a really interesting setting. The visual language of the Fallout universe, like the fonts that they use and like the way that the vaults look and all that other stuff, it's really unique. So when you see something like that, you know instantly what you're looking at, right? Like it's such a strong visual language that they have with that. And the show itself, like the writing isn't amazing, but the characters are really good. The acting is really good. I mean, you've got, you know, Goggins out there being a ghoul, and he's just like, you know, the most Gogginsy ghoul you've ever seen. He's just basically playing a combination Gogginsy of every ghoul. Other Yeah, but you know what I'm saying? He's like playing a combination of every character he's ever played, where he's just this like, you know, sleazy, smarmy, ghoulish guy. And it's great. It's great. But one thing that kind of strikes me is that the visual style of Fallout is just so overwhelming that like it almost feels like you're watching somebody play a game. And it's really weird. Like, there are points in the game where you're like, oh, failed that dialogue check. And it's like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's really weird. Like, it feels like a lot of the interactions and the things that happen in the show are really just a visualization of what you would see in a game. And I don't know whether that's good or not. Like, part of me think that's kind of lame. Like, it detracts from whatever narrative they're trying to build. But on the other hand, part of me is like, Fallout's still pretty cool. And it's interesting to see this in a television medium. So it's, to me, it's not like a great show, but it's a very interesting show. And, you know, I'm about 6 episodes into it, so I'm excited to see how it kind of resolves itself. There's only, you know, a few episodes left for me to watch. And I, you know, I like it. I don't think it's, like I said, not a great show. Not maybe one that I think everybody needs to go out and see immediately, but definitely if you're a fan of the games, check it out just because it's interesting. There's a lot to think about with how they constructed the show and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know. Thanks for asking that question. Cause it's, you know, there's been a lot of video game adaptations. I'm a big, you know, video game guy. There's been a lot of video game adaptations in the past few years, some much more successful than others. And the choices that these creators make in trying to translate one medium into another is just, to me, really fascinating. So it's been cool to watch that process. I really liked, for instance, I liked The Last of Us series on HBO. I thought that was pretty cool. So, but on the other hand, you know, sometimes you get the first Super Mario Brothers movie with Bob Hoskins and John Leguizamo.
By the way, Johnny, big RPG fan, Johnny refuses to play Elden Ring. So ask us anything, community.
Let's harass him a little bit to get him
on that.
I just haven't played it yet. I will get to it. I promise. I will get to it. So that's Ask Us Anything. Keep sending us those questions to dubcast@11warriors.com. Let's wrap up on a few things here, a few stories that I enjoy. Arkansas hired John Calipari right after he stepped down for Kentucky. I really love this story, in part because all these reports have been coming out saying, like, Coach Cal basically just stopped doing his job at a certain point. Didn't show up for media obligations, said, stupid, which is insane for a guy making $8 million a year, right? First of all, also you're at Kentucky, which is like one of
the
most
$33 million buyout. Wouldn't you do that too? Come on.
Like what?
And you want it out?
I don't know. I mean, the whole thing is just absolutely bonkers to me. So that's a crazy, you know, that's a crazy thing. And then, he gets hired at Arkansas the next day after he steps down, which fine. I mean, Arkansas's got there's a lot of tradition there and whatnot. They've had some good coaches and players over the years, but just a wild story. And
well, the wild Ohio State angle with it is that apparently he was interested in
the
Buckeye coaching vacancy. And which that would have been a big splash hire for Bjork. And instead they decided to promote from within. How do you feel about that?
I feel great about that because I think Coach Cal is washed. And this to me seems like a guy who was looking for any port in a storm. And I'm glad that Ohio State decided not to make themselves that port, because I don't want to hire a guy who's like fleeing from a blue blood for any job that he can get. And begging teams to give him an interview. I think that's a bad look and suggests that something is not going great.
Well, and not only that, but it is kind of amusing that as we've pivoted into the NIL era, the success for Calipari at Kentucky kind of, if not took a nosedive, at least fell well short of expectations relative to the success they had the 100% decade prior, which is an interesting congruency, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like all of a sudden the playing field gets leveled relative to, you know, financial obligations for college players. And suddenly Coach Cal loses his edge and starts fumbling games against Oakland and St. Peter's.
Right. Right. When you're not relying on one and dones. Yeah, it's interesting. It's really interesting. And
we'll see how he's able to attract talent to Fayetteville.
Well, here's the other thing. I mean, Arkansas is not a good team. I mean, it's not like he's going into a nice situation where he can just kind of step in and take a 20-win team to the promised land. He's got to do a huge rebuild there, and that's going to be really
difficult.
They've
been decently successful under Musselman in recent seasons. Better certainly, I think, the last 5 years than they've, you know, really enjoyed in basketball for a while. So I don't necessarily think it's a full – if he had to go to a total, like – tear down, build up from scratch thing, I don't think he would have been interested in it. I think there's certainly more infrastructure there based on recent success they've had than perhaps, you know, a lot of other SEC teams even. So I don't necessarily agree with that. I think it kind of makes sense. I am surprised at the proximity of the move, like especially staying within conference in the SEC. I think that's even though he is, I think, well, I don't know how much West East matters in basketball really, but that's, It's still interesting to me that he stayed so close to a place that is going to have a lot of like vitriol and incentive to battle back at him. But then again, we don't know how Pope is going to do relative to the kind of free fall that they're in. But
that was the other thing. Yeah. Okay. So that's the other element of this, which is, okay, you're Kentucky. You have this long story tradition of being this blue blood team, you know, the great going back, you know, decades and decades and decades. And you
none
get
of
the
top
BYU
players
dude?
Want the job.
Yeah, you get the BYU dude. Like, I'm not saying he's a bad coach. I'm just saying that's not the hire I expected them to make. Like, you know, you've got to put out feelers. I understand what, you know, the time of year that it is and all the other stuff, but like, you should be able to have the clout. I guess what I'm saying is you're not looking for guys looking for an out. You're looking for guys that you can, like, you know, nab from, I don't know, like the Floridas of the world. You know what I'm saying? Like places, I'm not yeah. saying Florida specifically, but you know what I'm saying? Like the B tier teams where you're like, okay, this is an up and coming coach. If you want to make your mark on the, you know, college basketball world, you're going to come to Kentucky. And there should be a lot of guys lining up for that opportunity. And it just didn't seem
like
that
Rick
was actually
Pitino.
The case. Yeah, that's right. Why didn't Rick Pitino is a successful coach. How would they not? How could they not make
it? I thought they should have just leaned all the way into doing it. Like, I feel like Pope is like a halfway in, halfway out hire for them.
I do too.
Like, if you're in a crisis state where this guy who had, I mean, because this is really what I think the bigger issue for them as a program was. Calipari had a $33 million buyout. Mm-hmm. It was going to go down to $27 million next season. The fact that he voluntarily punted on that to go to Arkansas, like
that
he
says
must
a
have,
lot about
things must have become really, really bad yeah. enough there, and he was unhappy enough to walk away from that amount of money.
Right.
Chris Holtmann yeah. wasn't walking away from eight figures.
Chris Holtmann had a $33 million buyout. He was like, "You're gonna drag me out of here."
I mean, he negotiated it down. I right. think, or was it up or down? I'm not, I think they negotiated it down like slightly right. from what it was, but it was still like eight figures. But the point with that is like the other coaches see that and they're mm-hmm. thinking, why would I want to go into a situation like that? Especially if I have something good over here, even at a program that may not necessarily have the prestige that Kentucky does. And then they end up with Pope. Right. But somebody who wouldn't have really cared about those things and is still pretty loyal to Kentucky is Rick Pitino. So if you recognize that you're in a position where our brand is kind of tarnished by what Cal just did, why would you not go back to someone whose brand has also kind of been tarnished and try not to see if two negatives can make a positive? Instead, they go with the holy image.
Two wrongs
of Pope,
make a right, Lisa.
The holy image of the BYU guy. Like,
how old is Rick Pitino at this point? I just looked up. He's 71 years old.
Who knows? He could have been
him.
Their savior in his big white suit, and now they're stuck with, you know, this guy out of BYU. So we'll see how it works out for them, but the SEC is a much more competitive basketball conference now than it was when Calipari got there a long time ago. So I can't say the prognosis for them is great.
I agree. Pitino, by the way. All right. So he was at Iona, had two 25-plus win seasons there, got hired at St. John's, 20-13 this year, declined an NIT invite. So a little too good for that, whereas apparently Ohio State was not. So I'm just saying. We'll see. Another thing I want to talk about, this is a fun story over the weekend, especially if you're into golf. Neil Shipley, a grad student at Ohio State golfer, was the amateur on the tour who advanced the furthest. He's the 2024, they call it the low amateur, which really definitely sounds like a backhanded compliment, but whatever. He gets to stand next to a dude with a green jacket. That's fun. Gets a yellow jacket, I guess. I'm kidding. He doesn't get a yellow jacket. That's a Happy Gilmore reference. And then had a very memeable moment afterwards when he was getting interviewed and just kept looking off screen at something that nobody could really see. Yeah, he just kept going like,
yeah, real Ricky Bobby moment. Yeah. I don't know what to do with my hands.
So anyway, congrats to that dude. Hopefully that now means that he can apply for an Augusta membership.
And so hopefully that won't be his last on-camera moment at the Masters.
Yeah, I don't
know. Something more noteworthy than that.
Agree.
At some point.
But, you know, good for him. Congrats. That's awesome. And you'll love to see it. You'll love to see it, especially with Ohio State's rich history of golfing, you know, excellence.
They had one guy that was pretty good, right?
I don't know. Maybe Jack something. I don't know. It's fine. Sure. last thing I want to talk about real quick. So some Ohio MMA UFC news. Kayla Harrison, I gotta throw this in here. Native of Middletown, Ohio.
Let's go.
That's right. Went to the same middle school I did, a couple years behind me. Went out there and dominated Holly Holm. And she's now in the UFC, I guess, right? She was doing PLA stuff. Was it PLA?
PFL.
Was it called PFL? Okay. Yeah. I just actually spoke with the PLA. Sorry, that's a different thing. PFL, where she won a couple of things there, and now it looks like she's ready to dominate on the UFC. So
it was like the only question people had was, with how like insanely ripped she is, how is she going to make 135 pounds? Because the UFC doesn't have a women's featherweight division anymore.
Oh yeah, that's
at 145, that's right. And she was on the scale within 20 minutes on Friday. She crushed it. And if she's able to make 135 for a championship bout, granted, Holly Holm is like 41 or 42, not necessarily in the prime range of where she was when she took out Ronda Rousey, but still was one of the top five bantamweights in the UFC. And Kayla Harrison made it a non-competitive fight. Joe Rogan,
I saw her kick her in the head, and then I was like, well, that's it.
Joe Rogan said her back looks like Vitor Belfort's, and she really does. Like, she is built unlike anybody else fighting in that division. And with her judo credentials and, you know, all the success that she already had in the PFL, and the only woman that has even beaten her in MMA was someone that had already had to fight her two previous times, so had a lot of experience in the cage already taking her on in what was like a competitive fight anyway. Many people are coming out of that thinking that Kayla Harrison is going to be UFC bantamweight champion. The only real question now is, does she lure Amanda Lemos, the GOAT, out of retirement? And that would be a fight that a lot of people really want to see. So congrats to Kayla Harrison for repping Ohio MMA very well, just as Mark Coleman did in putting on the BMF title on Max Holloway after what was one of the most sensational finishes in the history of the sport on Saturday night. It was an awesome card all around, except if you're a fan of fellow Ohio native Cody Garbrandt, who got submitted by Figgy.
That's unfortunate. But yeah, shout out to all them. That's fantastic. And you know, I've always said, if you're from Middletown, you're a great MMA fighter. nobody stepped to me. Just don't even bother. Just assume that I am my fists are lethal weapons. Just assume that, because please assume it. Please don't test that theory. So that's
Johnny the Violent Librarian Ginter.
That's
right.
That's got to be, you know what, I'm sure that was like some really fringe WWF wrestler from like the 1970s or 80s that lasted for about a week, and then everyone was like, this guy sucks.
That would be a great MMA nickname, the Librarian.
That's right, the Scholar of Pain. So that's the Dubcast for this week. We'll be back next week to talk about all the comings and goings of Ohio State sports and beyond, including the draft. The draft is coming up. We have not talked about the draft. We need to talk about the draft. We're going to get into it. Yes. So we'll get into all that before the draft starts in just a few weeks, I guess. Even less than that. So until then, I'm Johnny.
I'm George.
And we'll see you next time.
Take care, folks.